Tonight on this recorded edition of Extension 720, a reunion with an old friend who's got a new book, Joseph Epstein. I think the last time you were here, we were talking about your book on snobbery, which became a bestseller virtually.
Yes, I am now...
Did I say virtually or actually?
Actually. Not a J.K. Rowling bestseller or a Hillary Clinton bestseller, mm-hmm. but a modest bestseller.
We haven't had as interesting a life as Hillary Clinton.
No. I should tell you that my editor at Houghton Mifflin says, once you're a national bestseller, which means that you've appeared on certain lists and certain weeks, bestseller lists, you are always a national bestseller. So mm-hmm. on my grave, I think it will say Joseph Epstein, mediocre husband, rather indifferent father, national bestseller.
And a raconteur of considerable charm. And in fact, a man of a wide range of literary interests and commitments. One thing occurred to me, after all, I've known you for quite a while, and I've read a great deal of what you've done, certainly your literary essays in the various books that have collected them. What was the title of the last collection?
The last collection was something called Narcissus Leaves the Pool, yeah. And before that, a book on other writers called Life Sentences.
And what occurred to me is that when you do your literary thinking mm-hmm. and your literary writing, critical essays of great sensitivity, of great interest, wonderful stories worked into them. They're excellent creations, but they are about major figures more often in European literature than in American literature. Mm-hmm. And you wander far afield, always appreciatively. I loved your essay, for example, on Chamfort, a writer that very few people listening mm-hmm. to us probably know, a French mm-hmm. Embittered satirist of considerable
quality.
Aphorist, certainly. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the fiction that you've done, the short stories, and is this new book, Fabulous Small Jews, the third collection of short stories?
It's my second collection.
The second.
Right.
The Golden Boys was the other one. All of your short stories are indeed about fabulous Jews, small or otherwise. Most of them set in Chicago. In other words, in your fiction, you stay very close to home.
I hadn't been presented with that point, but it's
pretty
actually true.
It's
an obvious point. I seem to be a cosmopolitan literary writer, mm-hmm. and yet a homeboy.
What do you make of that?
I think maybe I make, to begin with, a case of serious schizophrenia, I suppose. But I do make of it that fiction is really sort of what I know. I mean, Chicago is what I know to turn into fictional material. And the other is sort of the Joseph Epstein who is post... let's say 21 years old or older.
Mm-hmm.
There's a remark of Mordecai Rickler's that you may have encountered. He, a Canadian novelist who died last year.
Yeah.
He said he divided his life between the time before and after he made the decision to become a writer. And he said the time before was better. And he didn't go on to say anything further about it, but what I think he meant was that life seemed more vivid before this decision is made. One dealt more immediately with one's experience, whereas after, life becomes copy. Everything one does is copy. How am I going to use this for my writing and so forth? And I think a lot of these stories, even though they're based on people in a loose way that I knew as an adult in my 40s and 50s even, have the setting of my childhood and young manhood, and it's very vivid to me.
Yeah, for a Chicago reader, there are many locations that one instantly recognizes.
High schools are mentioned in street names.
Did you go to Senn High School, in fact?
I did go to Senn High School.
Well, Senn turns up in a number of stories.
Yes, I like to think of Senn High School now as a wonderful place to go to school, but I think when I went there, it was best characterized as a school for mentally disturbed teachers. Almost none of us did very well, but it was a great place to go.
I had the thought that what we have here are roman en clé, these stories drawn from life. For instance, the short stories, they're petit roman en clé. But I recognized a number of people in these, particularly stories about significant literary figures. I'm not giving the game away if I say that there's a story about Lionel Trilling and his wife Diana.
There is such a story. It's called The Executors. But what I did with the story is I turned it around.
You put him in Princeton to begin with.
I put him in Princeton.
Rather than Columbia.
Correct. I de-Judanized Diana Trilling and made her Gentile.
Yes, I couldn't understand why you did that.
And I changed really the story of the Trillings' lives. That I think the Trillings' marital story, the post-marital story, was that Diana wrote a couple of memoirs in which she said that Lionel Trilling, who was the more famous of the mm-hmm. Trillings, was a depressive, he was a heavy drinker, she really sort of turned him in. And what I did in the story is I made it quite the reverse. I had a Lionel Trilling, after his death, leaves a number of poems which disqualifies his wife.
Which convey very bitter views of his marriage with her. In fact, were you also saying that he... I don't know that he ever wrote poetry. I suppose he must have done some poems, but...
No, he wrote fiction.
And the Middle of the Journey is that one novel of his which is really about the Hiss Chambers case.
Exactly. It's not a great novel, but it's a good novel.
It's an interesting one.
And he wrote a couple of memorable short stories.
Oh, yes. The one supposedly based upon his contact with...
Allen Ginsberg.
With Allen Ginsberg.
Right, and another...
What's the name of that story?
I can't remember that. It's a famous story.
Are the Voices, are there something?
No, that's Truman Capote. Yeah. Everything, but it's from that era. It has good swinging kind of lilting title. I think Lionel Trilling was probably a frustrated fictional artist, and instead wrote these very delicate, subtle, hesitant E.M. Forster, T.S. Eliot-like essays. Some of his journals have been published, and in the journals he makes himself out a kind of failure for not having the courage to stick with art as opposed to criticism.
One must raise the basic question. You're Jewish, I'm Jewish, but how come all your stories are about Jews?
they actually are. There are a few Gentile characters in the story.
Yeah, but they're interacting with Jews.
This is true. I'm a connoisseur of Jews, I guess.
A
collector of Jews. Whenever you say connoisseur, I always think of kind of sewer, a kind of, of Jews, and it's what I know. Somebody said to me, Milt, about these stories, someone said, you know, most of the characters are Jews, and some are small, some are not so small. But what makes them fabulous?
And that was the next question I was about to raise, of course.
Anticipate you. What makes them fabulous in some way is I think they're fabled. That is to say, they're going to disappear soon. In writing these stories, I think I'm writing about people who existed, were prominent, but aren't going to be around for very much longer. There's a story now about a Jewish couple, and they have a son, and they name their son Shmuel. And somebody says to them, what an extraordinary thing to name a boy at this in 2003. How did you come to name Shmuel? And they say, oh, it's named after his grandfather, Sean. And the idea is these old Jewish characters are kind of not going to be around any longer. Yeah. One of my stories.
Well, you mean a pattern of Jewish identity, a pattern of Jewish character, and of Jewish, you literary guys speak of sensibility, a certain kind of crude sensibility for the commercial Jews that you deal with in many of your stories. But still, and there are obsessions and raging concerns that never go away through a long life. You don't completely admire some of these guys, particularly the business guys that show up, but you have an empathic connection to them.
I hope so.
But you feel that their type is gone.
I think.
Or is rapidly going.
They're on the way out.
Because American Jews are now quite acculturated and quite altered, unless they're Orthodox.
Correct. And then it's a very different segment of the population. The other thing about a lot of these characters, I think, is that they're caught in what I call the cultural switch. They grew up with one set of values, beliefs, principles, and poof, they all disappeared. A friend of mine said to me not long ago, he said, you know, when we were young kids, late adolescents and young men, you'd go into a drugstore and you'd say, give me a pack of Luckies, please. And by the way, can I get some condoms? Now you go into a drugstore and you say, I'd like a package of condoms, you know, the kind that are pre-lubricated. They have the kind of velveteen outside. And do you have some Marlboros back there? And it's absolutely what's happened.
I suppose.
Tom Lear says, I was reading a book about comedians, and Tom Lear says, when I was a young man, there were certain things you couldn't say to a girl. Now you can say anything, but you can't call her a girl. You know, it's the cultural switch, and a lot of these guys sort of don't know what's hit them, and a lot of us don't either, I think, if we're beyond 55.
You know, it's interesting. Somebody else who's much interested in some of his novels made a good deal of sort of the Chicago Jewish scene, and some of these characters, the kind of guys who sit around having mm-hmm. bagels and coffee yeah. and telling stories and telling funny jokes, sometimes dirty jokes, mm-hmm. and gossiping about other guys and their fallibilities. The other writer who's been much interested in that, mm-hmm. in some, if not all, of his work, is, of course, Saul Bellow.
Yes, absolutely. There's been some talk, occasionally someone will say this has a Bellow feel about it. I think there's a difference. I would say the difference is this, that Bellow's main setting is usually there's a Bellow character, and he's intellectual and dreamy,
yeah.
and these rougher characters are all sort of informing him about reality. They're his reality instructors. I don't think I sort of play that game. The game, and it often he plays it for comedy, and very successfully much of the time, I must say. I'm sort of just interested them in, intrinsically interested in guys who still are playing handball.
Yeah.
Wearing three ace bandages.
That's the fellow. What's his name?
Glyph? It's the story Moe, the handball player.
Moe, the handball player.
Right. And yeah. If that's the one you're thinking of.
Well, isn't Artie Glick? No, who's the fellow who gets a diagnosis that he's got heart trouble and will die unless he gets a...
That's Moe, the handball
that's
player.
That's Moe, the handball player, yes. Yeah. I read that story with mm-hmm. some special interest.
As a grandfather, you must have done.
To be sure?
Yes. No, yeah. And his grandson is the victim of a broken marriage. And yeah. And his little grandson's in therapy, which sickens him, you know, an eight-year-old boy. And he's already worried about eating yogurt for breakfast. And
There's another angle on therapy. Who's that wonderful character who owns dry cleaning shops?
Yes, that's the story, Artie Glick.
That's Artie Glick.
Yes.
And we start with Artie and the psychiatrist.
Yes, right.
In fact, I would love to have you read a portion of that. The psychiatrist is absolutely insufferable.
Yes, quite so. I say... of the psychiatrist, yes, Dr. Monroe Lieberman, I'm reading now from the story, Dr. Monroe Lieberman, 5 years older than Artie, had himself been married 3 times and had 2 children with each of his wives. As far as Artie could determine, none of these kids had had it very easy. Lieberman's eldest child, Ariadne, was 40 years old, 60 pounds overweight, worked in a vintage clothing shop on Halsted Street, and she was the most successful of his children. Yet somehow, none of Lieberman's own domestic disasters, he frequently used them to illustrate his advice, seemed to put the least dent in his sublime confidence. Artie began going to him 13 years ago, not long after his father's death, at $75 an hour. He was now paying him $150. And this Lieberman, of course, tells him about Artie's big problem is he's got to get clear of his father who died 14 years ago.
And Artie, in fact, has started, we might hang with the story for a bit. It's just so wonderfully well structured.
Thank you.
I'm so delighted by its outcome. I was worried for a while.
Yes.
Well, tell the story.
Well, the story is really, it's a kind of Jamesian story. Mm-hmm. I mean, Henry James would not have known what to do with any of the characters in this story. But a common theme in Henry James stories is people trying to control and dominate other people. James thinks this is always the worst kind of mistake and tyranny. And in this case, we have a young man, not so young, he's in his late 50s, who is really being dominated by his shrink.
By Dr. Monroe Lieberman.
Dr. Monroe Lieberman, who keeps telling him, Artie, you've got Arthur, as he says in his, I imagine, very pompous, Arthur, you have a problem here with your father, and until that's solved, you, on and on. Meanwhile, the father was a character who was a Jewish tyrant of another kind, and if I could read a few paragraphs about this story, of this the father, his name was Harry Glick. He was an immigrant. He came to Chicago from Lodz at the age of 19 in 1928, and he started this successful dry cleaning business for which the son, Artie, works. And I'll read 3 paragraphs. In all their time together, when he was a boy, through the 22 years he worked with his father at top-notch cleaners, Artie could not recall a single calm conversation between them. His father lectured, hectored, badgered, argued, screamed, cursed. He lived in a state of continuous irritation, nor could Artie remember a time when the old man gave him credit for having any judgment. Once, when he was already a married man and 35 years old, Artie heard his father in his office at the plant say over the phone to one of his pinochle cronies, "Go on vacation? What are you kidding me? Who'd run the place? For help here, I got nothing but idiots." Artie felt his stomach turn over. He probably should have quit right then, but he was married, had in fact a childless and rocky marriage and no place to go. All he knew was the dry cleaning business. When Harry Glick had had his second heart attack and his physician had practically forced the man to take time off, from Florida he'd call Artie at least once every 2 hours, reminding him of this, telling him not to forget that, assuming always that his now 43-year-old son had no brains, no common sense. Always behind his father's questions, instructions, advice, there was a barely hidden anger. Was it, Artie wondered, directed at him or at the world? He never felt he could ask. He never really found out why his father was always so ticked off. His father's bypass surgery was done at St. Francis Hospital in Evanston, where the head of the coronary unit was a lean surgeon, tall, lean surgeon named Tom Murphy. When Artie first saw him, he thought Dr. Murphy ought to be wearing a white silk scarf, for he looked more like a test pilot than a surgeon. Dr. Murphy told Artie that the surgery was very iffy. The two attacks had greatly weakened his father's heart, yet there was no choice but to operate. Artie was in his father's room when the orderlies came to take him down to surgery. He called Artie over to his bed, beckoning him to lean over so that he could whisper in his ear. Artie thought his father had something deeply personal to tell him. Instead, he pointed to the slender bronze crucifix on the wall above his bed, and in his accented English whispered, "If I didn't come out of this alive, take that crush off the wall and shove it up this guy Murphy's tachas." His father died on the operating table. So far as Artie knew, these were Harry Glick's last words.
We need to stay with Harry Glick, because love comes to Harry Glick in a sort of an interesting way.
To Artie, actually.
To Artie, to Artie Glick, the son of Harry.
Right.
And we'll continue in that story, perhaps bringing it to its culmination, after we pause for these words. And we return to Joseph Epstein, one of the leading literary figures of the town, and now that he's a bestseller, one of the leading literary figures of the nation. Indeed, of all the world.
Exactly.
Heute gehört von Chicago, morgen die ganze Welt. The new book, a collection of short stories, is titled Fabulous Small Jews. And I finally understood, fabulous, you say it's, that really stands in for fabled.
I think so.
And these are fabled Jews because the type is passing.
I think so. I should tell you that the origin of the story, which you origin of the title, which you probably captured already or caught because it appears in the epigraph, comes from a Carl Shapiro poem that I read, I think, maybe 30 years ago. It's called Hospital. And the pertinent portion goes, "This Oxford of all sicknesses, kings have lain here, and fabulous small Jews, and actresses whose legs were always news." It sounds to me very 1940s. Mm-hmm. You know, that actress is Betty Grable, I assume. And, you know, I always think of it as fabulous small Jews.
Carl Shapiro was here on the program one night.
It was he,
And he was a smoker, and he was rather offended by all of the anti-tobacco stuff.
Oh, really? He was an angry man toward the end of his life.
And so he had written a poem about it, which is about the joy of smoking after sexual intercourse. And it conveys that whole scene lavishly and beautifully.
Right.
He read it for us on the
radio.
Really? But back to Glick.
Yes, Artie.
Artie Glick.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that makes Artie's life interesting, he really doesn't have much of a life. He's a you mentioned earlier of my naming place names in around Chicago. He's a McClurg Court. He's one of the McClurg Court regulars.
And he hangs out at that that gym at McClurg Court.
Exactly, the McClurg Court Health Club.
It's a health club, not a gym.
Right, where the old athletes from Sen and Sullivan and Von Steuben and Roosevelt talk stock tips, sports, and sex in the sauna.
In that order.
In that order, right. Changing over the years. And he works 12-hour day at his cleaning plant, and the rest of he spends 2 hours a week with Dr. Lieberman. He doesn't have much of a life. And then at one point, he meets up with a young lawyer named Lindsay Connors, with whom he makes pregnant, although she blames him. She takes full responsibility for it. And he decides to marry her, although she puts no pressure on him.
There's a wonderful line in there, you must quote it, right after their first sexual encounter, when she says...
Yes, I remember the line actually by heart. She says, they have two business meetings and a dinner at Kiki's, and the first time they go to bed together, she says, "You know, that was so nice, I don't think I'll even bill you for it."
Yes.
Good lawyerly, And in any case, Dr. Lieberman doesn't want him to marry because Dr. Lieberman is really wants to control his destiny.
Yeah, he tells him, "Arthur, this will end very badly."
Exactly. And toward he already is rather ashamed of being in therapy. He doesn't tell anybody about it, doesn't tell his brother, but he determines to tell her one night, and he says that he's been seeing a shrink, and she says, oh, she says, Jewish golf.
Yes.
And he says, Jewish golf? He says, well, it's what Jews, Jews have therapy, whereas Gentiles have golf. Gentiles try to improve their backswing, Jews their past. It doesn't seem to work much in either case, she says. And she's this brilliant, smart, fearless young woman.
I quite liked her.
Yeah, no, we should all have had a girlfriend like that when, at some point early in our lives. You know?
But should we give the ending away as well?
Well,
he's in some conflict when the psychiatrist warns him off.
Yes, oh yes, he always thinks maybe the psychiatrist is right. Yeah. And for those of us who've known people in intensive psychotherapy, one of their greatest victories is getting out of the damn thing. Karl Kraus, the Viennese wit, said, psychoanalysis is the disease for which it purports to be the cure.
And wasn't that prescient of old Karl Kraus, his living down the street, so to speak?
Yes, from the doctor himself, yes, from the great Sigmundo himself, yes. So he has to, I think we can give away one story.
I think so. And you must read the letter to the psychiatrist with which he kisses him off.
We'll be pleased to. He, in any case, one after a long session, which the psychiatrist threatens to leave Artie if he doesn't follow his advice, he meets Lindsay Connors, this attractive lawyer, 20 or so years
and
younger.
And Binion's across from the Standard Club.
Exactly.
But it's no longer there.
There's no longer a Binion's, a restaurant my wife and I used to go to.
Yeah, great little place.
And she presents him with some interesting news, having had a sonogram. Not only is she going to have a child, she's going to have twins, identical twin boys. And this 57-year-old, vaguely depressed, psychoanically driven character has to face a marriage of this kind. He sees himself forever going through airports with one of those double strollers with two small blonde children in it. And yet he wants it. He decides it's a chance for life himself. And after there's a scene in Binion's in which he says to the boys, he said, lifting his drink, and she said, to neurosis, she added, they clink glasses. That evening alone in his apartment, Artie took out a sheet of paper and began a letter. Dear Dr. Lieberman, this is to let you know that I'm to be the father of twin boys due in December. I am marrying early next month. I would like you to know that I have thought over all that you have said and decided that, even if it's wise, it's wisdom I cannot use, cannot afford, at least not at this juncture in my life. I admire your confidence and sense of certainty about my life. I wish I had some of it myself, but I don't, and probably never will. I'm apparently one of those people who have to take things as they come. If anything, I feel I have lived all too carefully over the past years. It hasn't helped. I realize that at my age, attempting to raise twin boys is really putting myself in for it. But just now, I mean right at this very moment, it seems pretty damn fine to me. It feels like life is calling out to me. One last chance not to live under someone else's tyranny, including, I hope you'll forgive me for saying so, Doctor, yours, but in a sweet chaos of my own making. Screw it, Dr. Lieberman, but time is running out, and if I don't get in the game now, I never will. Please cancel my appointment for next Thursday and for every Tuesday and Thursday thereafter. Finally, I note that I owe you for 7 sessions the sum of $1,050. I've decided not to pay. I've decided you have enough of my money as it is. Besides, I can use the money to buy one of those double strollers and spend the rest on diapers, which probably aren't cheap. If you want to attempt to collect this money, I invite you to turn it over to a collection agency. But I think you should know that on my side, I have a terrific lawyer. Sincerely, he signed the letter in a large, bold hand, Artie.
Yeah.
I'm glad you liked that
it's
story.
It's a perfect little story.
Oh, thank you.
You know, even while you were reading that, I was combining that with our conversation a bit earlier about the Trillings, who are the figures from which you draw or upon which you build another story. The title of that story is?
The Executor.
The Executor. Because the young fellow who becomes his disciple is asked to be the executor of his will, of the professor's will. Diana Trilling, in the memoir she wrote after the death of her husband, some years after the death of her husband, reveals that both of them were absolutely nutty in their commitment to psychoanalysis.
Absolutely.
And most of the psychoanalysts she describes are are disgraceful people, totally incompetent. One of them is a drug addict, and others equally have families as disorganized and as deeply failed as Dr. Lieberman, whose six kids haven't worked out particularly well, except that Ariadne is in her own Naxos on Halsted Avenue, is it?
Yes.
What was it about the Jews of that time, including people like you and me, that is to say, you know, intellectoid Jews who populated universities, that made them so devoted to the search for perfection or for the reworking of one's past and to the dream that psychoanalysis, which is really basically a rather fraudulent operation,
absolutely,
that psychoanalysis will transform you?
Yes. No, I...
What was that all about?
Well, you know, it didn't hit me completely. I first encountered these ideas at the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
Where as a sophomore, one was invited to read Civilization and Its Discontents, which at 19 was really a kick in the head, as the great Frank Sinatra would say.
Yeah.
Ain't that a kick in the head? And it seemed to me, because of being brought up in the kind of lower middle class, business-oriented life I was lucky in having a kind of strong reality factor. And I'd said to myself, wait a minute here, I don't wish either to sleep with my mother or kill my father. My father's a very decent man. He's been paying my way all these years and asking nothing of me in return. Yeah. But when I went to New York, almost everyone I knew was in psychotherapy or analysis.
Yeah.
And moreover, there was the slight feeling that if you weren't, you were a kind of callow and maybe cowardly person.
Sure.
You didn't want to examine your depths. And it went on and on and on. And of course, now we don't believe in those basic things. I don't know anyone who really believes in the Oedipus complex anymore. It's just a dopey idea, right?
Well,
now.
Except there are psychoanalysts. They've got their Chicago Institute just down the street from where we are.
They've
got to make something of this stuff, but they've reworked it so much.
Exactly.
And it's really an embarrassment to them. Mm-hmm. But what they have not yet fully acknowledged is that their therapy doesn't work either.
No, absolutely. There are no cures. You know, they just go on and on. I had dinner with a very nice woman psychoanalyst, southerner, and I said, to her, sort of putting the stick in her ribs gently, because I'm not a very confrontational person, I said, how's business? And she said, well, you know, that Oedipus thing hasn't really quite worked out, has it? And I said, no, that's my sense of it. She says, I'm really now dealing with people sort of on individual problems. They come to me and I sort of tell them, sure,
do that. And that's where the best of them can render some service.
Yes,
it's having a paid counselor.
Exactly. I must say, in that same Artie Glick story, this Lindsay Connor says when she was at Mount Holyoke, among her fellow students were Jews. She said about a third of them were in psychoanalysis or psychotherapy. Another third were very much hipped on modern art. And the last third were taken up by radical politics. She said some were interested in all three, and then she says they hit the trifecta.
Yeah.
There is something about Jewish intellectoids, as you say, of that era, who seemed to have to go for one of those three things.
Talk to me a bit about this particular medium, this genre, as they say in literary circles, namely the short story.
Mm-hmm.
It has a long history. In fact, just the other night, we did a program with Leon Kass on his new book on the Book of Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Book of Genesis has a number of whopping good yarns in
it. Yes, absolutely.
And you can isolate them. You can take them out and make them short stories.
Yeah, they are. They're great short stories, most of them, I agree.
Who are your models, though? It isn't the Book of Genesis that you draw
from. No, it's not the Book of Genesis.
Is it Maupassant? Is it O. Henry?
It's some Maupassant. It's a little bit of O. Henry, although I'm not such a surprise-ending man for the most part. I grew up on reading a vast amount of short stories. I think there's a question behind your question, and that is, I'm a lucky writer in that I seem to have two forms. I can write familiar essays.
Yeah, three forms. The literary essay, the familiar essay about life, aspects of life, and the short story.
And the short story.
I'm looking for your novel. There must be one in the drawer.
Well, I wonder if there is. I hope. It's not in the drawer yet.
No?
I can promise you that. But the question is, if you're a writer, and that is to say you're a pig for experience, when you acquire experience, the question for someone who has more than one form is, what form should this experience take? And I think of certain certain recent essays I've written. I wrote an essay about Edward Shields, who was a teacher at Chicago, whom you knew, I think.
Yeah, he was very close to him.
I was very close. He was my dearest friend. And he was a spectacular person, Edward Schultz. He's someone who was born the son of a Jewish cigar maker. He sort of reinvented himself in the most complete way, such that people didn't know if he was English or American. They didn't know if he was Jewish or Gentile. He was, Eliot once said of Henry James, he is a pure European but of no known country. And Edward was a little like that. He had the most rapid-fire wit I have ever seen in a man. I once said to him that somebody of a rather pretentious Czech we both knew reported to me that so haute bourgeois was his family that his father had never shaved himself in his entire life. I reported this to Edward without missing a beat. He said, you know, the truth is, Joseph, his father probably shaved his mother. You know, he had that kind of rapid fire thing.
Rather cruel. Yeah.
That cruel, but, you know, he didn't say it in front of him. But
it was Schills, to quote another, is cruel bon mot, or epigrammatic precise killing moments, said of the Reverend Andrew Greeley, now a famous, quote, novelist, when Greeley was denied tenure at Chicago, the famous Schills line was, the trouble with Father Greeley is he's never had an unpublished thought.
That's good. You know, he said something similar to me, because Greeley once said to me, tell your friend, ask your friend Schills why he won't let me have tenure.
Yeah.
And I reported this to Edward, and he said, you must tell him that it has nothing to do with his being Catholic or a priest, but it has to do with his all-pervasive mediocrity. I did not report back to Father Greeley about that. But in any case, here's this man, Edward Schills. He's extraordinarily large, and it would not occur to me to somehow put him in a novel. He has two cameo roles in two different Saul Bellow novels, so he doesn't come out to a...
He's sort of Mr. Samler, is he not?
I don't think quite, but I think he supplied a lot of information for that figure.
Samler is too much of a failure and too much of an outcast.
Yes, and Samler is in fact a European who's seen the Holocaust, he's looked the devil in the eye. But it occurred to me this is not for a story. This is too direct and interesting, straight out. And one of the things I've sort of been formulating this question, it seems to me that essays, even familiar ones, deal with ideas, with arguments, with direct experience. And stories, for me, deal with more oblique matters, things that you can't quite understand what's going on, things that touch on the instincts, the feelings, the heart. Again, to quote Eliot on James again, there's this wonderful line where Eliot says of James, he had a mind so fine, no idea could violate it.
Yeah.
And what I think he meant by that was not that Henry James couldn't handle ideas. I mean, he was the brother of William, one of the founders of American pragmatism. What I think he thought meant by it was that Henry James didn't think that ideas were the end of thought, that things of the above ideas, things the way we're affected by experience and feelings, that's where the real truths were for the artist.
Just also, in essays, you speak directly, so to speak.
That's right.
But in short stories of the kind that you do and that so many do, you're speaking aslant. You're not directly stating
that's
a thesis.
That's right. And you're inventing narrators to tell your story.
And you're implying, and you're ambiguifying, if such a word exists.
Sometimes, but you know, one of the things I notice about these stories, and when you gather together a sort of a collection of 18 stories, you sense the preoccupations of a decade, is that these are stories that don't really go for lyrically ambiguous endings or end in small epiphanies. You know?
No, they end in resolutions.
I think they do. And they're stories about people who are called upon to make a decision. Mm. For me, the drama of most of these stories is a decision. It's usually a moral decision.
Yeah.
I hesitate to use that word, but there it is.
No, you're entitled.
And I won't use it more than three times.
I've got a decision to make right now. That is, how do I get from here to the commercials, which are overdue? We'll go to those directly and then back to Joseph Epstein and perhaps another selection or two from Fabulous Small Jews. That book, by the way, is just recently published by Houghton Mifflin. We return after this. And we return to conversation with Joseph Epstein, whose most recent book is titled Fabulous Small Jews. The prior book of short stories was The Golden Boys. I have before me now the full list of your works, and I won't read the whole list, but...
I've killed a lot of trees, Milt.
No, I don't have it here, do I? Yes, here it is.
In the front, yes.
Yeah. The most recent was Snobbery, which we discussed here on this program. Narcissus Leaves the Pool was one of the collections of literary essays. Life Sentences was another literary essay collection. With My Trousers Rolled.
Yes, that was Familiar Essays.
Familiar Essays, yes. The line from Eliot's...
yes, I Grow Old, I Grow Old.
Proof Rock, right?
Right.
Yeah, and so on. The very first thing here is Divorced in America.
Yes, that was the first book I wrote in, I think, 1974. And I wrote it out of the being a graduate of that institution.
Is that so?
I wrote a book on that subject. I wrote it in the face of a time when divorce was thought to be a good and creative thing. And it seemed to me, for the most part, a dreary and sad thing. And I was kind of going against that grain, or at least I thought it was.
I think you were right in that perception, and that perception would hold to this day, I'm sure.
I think so.
Well, I haven't made any mention of the fact that for many years, you will remember exactly how many, unless you've got a protective amnesia over it all by now, you were the editor of a very important journal, The American Scholar.
Oh, I was. I was editor there from 1974 to 1997. I was, in effect, fired for not quite incorrect political opinions, but for not being sufficiently enthusiastic about certain things that went on in academic life. I didn't publish anything about feminism. I didn't publish much African-American stuff. And I didn't do so because I didn't think that it was very interesting stuff. And I think it galled the board of directors of Phi Beta Kappa, who were themselves academics, who were more with the show than I was. But I must tell you something about having been fired in this way. I am living under what is now known as the Brooks Robinson effect. Brooks Robinson, as you will know, was a great third baseman for the Baltimore Orioles. He's said to be the greatest fielding third baseman in history of the game, the modern game. And a friend told me, I'm enjoying the Brooks Robinson effect, is that after Brooks Robinson retired, there was a very good third baseman named Doug DeCensis who came to the Baltimore Orioles. And he was really very good, very able. And Doug DeCensis might have gone into on a foul ball, might have run toward the dugout, fell over the dugout railing, risked life and limb to catch this foul ball, and he would miss it. And fans would turn to each other and say, Brooks would have got it. And I get all sorts of mail that said, people say, you know, the magazine was so much better when you were there.
Yep.
You would never have permitted this and so forth. So the Brooks Robinson effect is what I'm living under.
Well, there's certainly a kind of a tone of liberal to leftist conformity
I think
visible in the pages of the American Scholar now.
I'm sort of officially committed not to saying anything bad about the magazine, but
it still has good articles.
Yeah, it has good things, but it is a different magazine under a different editor, Anne Fadiman.
Yeah, the daughter of Clifton.
Correct. Kip, as he was
Kip
known.
Kip Fadiman.
Yes.
Who was an interesting man in himself.
Yeah, very, in lots of ways. He was sort of with the Mortimer Adler Road Show in part.
They knew each other together at Columbia.
Yes, exactly.
When they were both very, very young men. I must mention, this is sort of out of all context, except his name has come up. He came and did a tape with me one afternoon some years ago. I hadn't met him once before. He did a book on wine. He was an enologist.
Yes,
amateur
yes.
enologist. Is that the word for it?
I think that's and, right. I have a tough time pronouncing that word, too.
And we did, that was many years ago. And then he had done a book for the Encyclopedia Britannica, some of the best from the history of the encyclopedia.
Yes.
And he had edited it and so on. And he was here for a session, some celebratory occasion for Mortimer Adler, whatever birthday, was it his 90th or something? We taped in the afternoon. And I had occasion to call him on something else about 2 years later at a home down in Florida. And he told me, well, I would like to do that. I'd like to read that, but, you know, I'm blind now. I said, no, I didn't know that. I'm sorry to hear it. He said, yes, it happened to me about a week after I was in Chicago for that occasion for Mortimer.
Really?
So, strangely,
he
was blind just a week after I last saw him.
I know he was. He was a... he was a funny kind of overly cultivated gent in a way. I remember he once said in my presence, there was someone else in the room, he said, you know, he was about 63, younger than we are now, certainly, and he said, what's left for me? He said, certain wines, a few cheeses.
Oh, dear.
I love that. I wonder God get him a corned beef sandwich, remind him of his humble origins.
Of course, he had an academic background, but he was sort of a public figure.
Yes.
And he ran for years that program, Information Please.
That's where his great fame was, yeah. the radio fame was, I mean, he was a national figure.
Yeah.
He was not, when we talk about national bestsellers, national figures, the thing you never want to be, Milt, is a national treasure.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's all over.
Oh, I don't know. It hasn't happened to me yet.
Yeah. Well, if it does, you'll know it's almost gone.
All right. Now this has been a wonderfully wandering conversation.
Yes,
we've been in many different directions. It's been rather gossipy. But back to the matter before us, namely, at least another story from Fabulous Small Jews.
Well, one of the things I wonder if it's a source of curiosity to you. I think it is. Where do stories come from? And in my case, they come from little incidents, little events, some odd fact that one learns. I read, for example, when Leonie Dale, the biographer of Henry James, died, I read in his obit that he owned a ring with a green stone, a gold ring that was owned by Henry James. And my first initial greedy impulse was to say, I would love to have that ring. And I started to write a story about someone who tries to get such a objet d'art from, mm-hmm. you know, with all this cultural cachet attaching to it. In another case, I was at dinner with the younger sister of the tennis player Seymour Greenberg. You have to be of a certain age to know that Seymour Greenberg in the 40s was ranked, I think, fifth in the nation as a tennis player.
Really? That one stumps me. That's one name.
You weren't a Chicago-born guy, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Seymour Greenberg has a secure niche in that smallest of rooms known as the Jewish Athletes Hall of Fame.
Uh-huh.
You know, but
where Hank Greenberg guards the portal.
Exactly. Right. And L. Rosen is serving hors d'oeuvre.
Uh-huh.
But in any case, I knew that he had Parkinson's, and his sister, next to whom I sat at this dinner at the home of friends, I asked about him, and she said, you know, I was out today buying heavier cutlery for Seymour. And that very detail of, you know, someone's tremulous hands,
mm-hmm.
and the light cutlery banging against the plate, he needed heavier cutlery just to eat, said that it just occurred to me there's something has to be written about this. It's too vivid. And 2 days later, I learned that a contemporary of mine had something called word loss retrieval. He couldn't retrieve words. Mm-hmm. It was the beginning of a dementia. And I somehow, between these two facts, was able to fashion a story about a man who was losing his physical prowess and another who was losing his mental prowess, and together they kind of become friends, and it sort of fell into place. But I wanted to read you something a little bit from a story called Uncle Jack, which is based on a misconception, but it still worked for me. When I was in high school, there was a young contemporary of mine whose mother, I'm not sure if I knew she was widowed or divorced, but it was said that she was the mistress of Sidney Korshak. Now, Sidney Korshak, maybe not everyone in your audience will know who he was. He was the great fix-it lawyer of all time.
Brother of Marshall, who was a big figure in Democratic politics in Chicago.
Correct. But Sidney was the man. In the biography of Louis Wasserman, the Hollywood kingmaker,
mm-hmm.
The eminence grise, or greasy eminence, as we say on the north side, is Sidney Korshak. And I always thought, as it turns out, it was false. This man's, my friends or acquaintances, mother was not the mistress of Sidney Korshak, but of some lawyer connected with the Korshak office. And I always wondered, what would it be like if you're a young boy and you your mother has this connection with this sort of quasi-crime figure? What would it be like? And I wrote a story about it called Uncle Jack. The portions of it that I think are to the point are the following. Last Thursday, heading out from the Loop to my apartment in Hyde Park, I was listening to a golden oldies station. They were playing tapes of famous radio programs, and one of them was from the old Art Linkletter show. Linkletter is asking a boy what he wants for Christmas, and the kid says he wants a new bed. Linkletter asks why. The kid says because he usually sleeps in the same bed with his mother, but now he has to sleep on the couch because his uncle is staying over with her. Only, you see, he isn't really his uncle. Roaring laughter follows. kids, the ever-unctuous, Linkletter signs off, say the darndest things. I winced. Although I didn't grow up sharing a bed with my mother, I too had one of those uncles who really wasn't my uncle. Only my uncle, as I would learn, was one of the most powerful men in America. Not many people knew about him, but the small handful who did used to refer to him as Mr. Fix-It. The It, as I was discovered when I grew older, covered a lot of territory. My uncle could get the unions off your back, or get you into a sweetheart contract, or get you a $1 million loan out of union pension funds at an attractive interest rate, at a time when $1 million was $1 million, and not the salary of a utility infielder. He could get zoning ordinances changed, or set in motion the gerrymandering of congressional districts. He could persuade all sorts of people in politics, show business, and sports not to be stubborn about deals and contracts. I heard it said, whispered actually, that, should it be required, he was the man to see if you needed to have a business partner or wife or husband removed in a quiet and completely efficient manner. Jack Rafter was my uncle's name. Well, I've never met Korshak, and I don't know that he did such things, but I know he did some of them. But
he was a fixer. He was involved also with the Central States Pension Fund or whatever it was, the big one from the Teamsters,
yes,
where another guy who was based in Skokie, a famous figure whose name I can't remember.
Dorfman, I think.
Alan Dorfman was shot
killed.
Down in the parking lot of the Purple Hotel.
The Purple Hotel, as they call it, yeah. The old Hyatt House in Skokie.
Exactly.
Yes, no. But this is part of the Chicago lore, I think, you know. And that,
well,
that
you know, when I read that, I thought instantly of a young woman of my acquaintance, who, and I will not otherwise identify her, who has told me that she had just that sort of life. Her mother had a friend who was a powerful person in Chicago
who was
there a lot, and it was always ambiguous as to why he was there, although later did she fully comprehend it.
Connected, as we say.
Yeah, and she retains a very fierce disdain for her mother.
Oh, for allowing herself to fall into this.
I guess. She doesn't talk about it much, but... Yes. You know,
well, the mother in this story is... The son loves her, and I think his love is not put off by this.
All of these stories, and there are some 18 in the book, did they all appear in commentary originally?
I think 13 of them did, and 5 appeared in the Hudson Review.
In the Hudson Review. Yeah. Say a word about that. To put it in mercantile terms, Jewish or otherwise, is there much of a market for this sort of thing?
From this he makes a living, as a relative of one said when I told him I was a writer and a teacher. From this he mach a leben. It's rather hard to get stories published. The perfect place to publish stories is the New Yorker, I think.
Yeah.
And I've never had a story in the New Yorker. I've written memoirs and criticism there. But I think the New Yorker stories, a little less now than before, were stories that ended in this kind of lyrical ambiguity that we were talking about. You know, Daniel realized that looking at the desultory moon, half moon hanging over the Bosphorus, Daniel realized that it would never again appear to him quite the same.
Yeah.
You know, I hate stories like that.
That catches the style.
Exactly. Yeah. So this kind of sort of straight story, I think, is not so easily published in the New Yorker or the Atlantic.
Who are the masters of the short story in contemporary fiction?
Gosh, in contemporary fiction today, I have to think about that.
Apart from you, that is.
Apart from me, yes. I always, when I talk about my own stories, I say I'm able to publishable stories. I don't know how good this fake modesty of mine.
No, they're wonderful. I enjoy them all.
Thanks. Today, who are they? I suppose Updike is still pretty good, though. Mm-hmm. He has a lot of moons over the Bosphorus, too, as you know. There's Alice Munro is good, the Canadian writer. I think she's awfully good. I read lots of short fiction. But then I'm just always interested in the whole question of the mystery of character.
As we come to a close, because the tape is just about run out,
I see.
Your next book continues what you started with, Snobbery.
Yes, it's a book on friendship, a rich, rich, complex subject.
I thought it was a book on envy.
No, forgive me. I've written a small book on envy that I've already written. And
not
it
yet
does
published.
Continue with Snobbery.
Yeah.
And it's a book, a book on the 7 deadly sins. I was assigned envy. You should know that what was left was lust, sloth, anger, and envy.
Did you have your choice?
I did. And it's a kind of Rorschach test. I used to ask people, what do you think I chose? And nobody said lust. What an insult. but envy, which is rich. But after that, I'm doing a book on friendship.
On friendship.
You know, it's a subject so rich. And you know, there are these classical ideals, Montaigne and Aristotle and such.
Cicero.
And Cicero.
Was a great essay
exactly,
on friendship.
Exactly. Yeah. But the modern friendship, I think, has changed in some fundamental way. And I think we don't think of friends in the same blood brother and blood sister way that we did. I find every line I write causes me to rethink everything.
And we rotate the friends more quickly, don't we?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, that's another conversation.
Good. I hope I'll be back and we'll both be here to do
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And the wonderful collection of short stories by Joseph Epstein, just recently published by Houghton Mifflin, is titled Fabulous Small Jews. And thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Mel.